Internets, disclaimer, before we start today's episode, our interview with Stacy Yui of the Radical History Club was recorded prior to the events of October 7th and the beginning of the Israeli-Gaza war. So in today's episode, we're going to have a lot of discussions about the effects of imperialism, U.S. foreign policy, and topics relating to those discussions, but there will be no discussion about anything related to Palestine or Gaza, because obviously that interview was recorded before the start of that conflict. So just a little disclaimer before we hop into this episode. So with that said, back to the program. Okay, what up? What up, San Diego? You're tuned into Louder Than a Bomb. I am your host, Rob Camacho, and joining me, I got the one and only
Jose Cortez, coming at you from San Diego, the red ghost haunting Southern California with the specter of communism.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, internets, radio, San Diego, wherever you're tuning into today, we got a wonderful guest on the show. Joining us today, we have Stacy Yui of Radical History Club. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, for just to jump in, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, where are you from and what is it exactly that you do?
My name is Stacy Yui. I'm originally from Bakersfield, California, Central Valley. I grew up there for the first or for all of my adolescence and then moved here for college to go to UCSD. I'm a graphic designer, I'm an amateur historian, a zine maker, an aspiring baby community organizer, I would say. And then I'm also the daughter of migrants from the Philippines.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah, Rob mentioned something that I think we should touch on, which was the name of a program that you put on called the Radical History Club. Can you just kind of go into the significance of why you chose that name versus the, like, I don't know, the Moderate History Club?
Yeah, exactly. Well, first I wanted it to be the club because I wanted it to feel like inclusive and like accessible to folks. I feel like academia and like the publishing industry, like they hoard their power by kind of like having everything feel exclusive and like everything's kind of out of reach, or you have to have a degree to be part of this work. So I really wanted it to be a club that felt like, I don't know, just like something you would do with your friends, or something that you could kind of like meet other people through it and like talk to each other about all of this really important history. And then I chose the word radical because, you know, at the time, radical kind of had like different meanings, right? Like on one side, people thought radical meant like going too extreme or like too far to the left. And then on the other side, radical also meant being the leader of like protests and like marches and stuff. But it actually, to me personally, radical is something else. It's almost like having the action and like passion to be able to take care of each other and to like have that influence every aspect of your life. Like, I feel like that is what we need in order to be okay, in order to survive these systems that we've been put in. So to me, that's why I wanted to call it Radical History Club, because that's, I mean, I feel like this knowledge is just so important to how we can free ourselves from the world that was built to imprison us, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. Perfectly said. Yeah, like, I think that's a perfect way to put it, because, like you said, like, a lot of, like, this work, it seems like it's inaccessible, like, if you're not, like, in academia or you don't have a degree, you know? So, one of the things I really appreciate about this series is that it's very informative, and there's a lot of information that's packed into them, but it's very concise, though. It's, awesome. You know, almost like a pocket guide, if you will, to, like, these specific topics. And, you know, kind of going into your history, you attended UCSD, like you said, and you earned degrees in history and psychology. And I wanted to ask, you know, like, what was like the
catalyst where you decided like you wanted to like work on this series and decide like, hey, like these are underappreciated topics and topics that like quite frankly aren't taught until you really, like you said, reach that collegiate level? Because we're talking about things in here like the Econo blowouts, we're talking about COINTELPRO, Reconstruction, a lot of things that if you don't attend higher education, you may not ever learn about them in an academic setting. So what inspired you to kind of set forth on this?
Yeah, I mean, like, full disclosure, you know, like, I did go to college. I did have the privilege of going to a university and getting that education, and I still think that I missed out on so much because I think, like, it really requires us to have a personal experience with this history in order to really feel like it can change your life. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, dramatic about it, but I really do think that like learning history that mattered to me and was about people who looked like me was so important to understanding like what my place in the world was. It's like really embarrassing because I didn't know anything about like Filipino American history until I was like in my 30s, like way past college, way past high school, like even doing some of the work that I had done previously with like other nonprofits. Like I used to volunteer with like the United Farm Workers Foundation, back when I was in Bakersfield. And I didn't even realize that like Filipinos had a place in that history. And I was so surprised to learn about, you know, how Filipino Manongs like organized to create a fairer wage, that they really had to organize alongside each other with very little resources and also build solidarity with Chicano folks to make sure that they had a working wage and that they could get respect and dignity in the work that they did. So I think when I learned about that history, I realized like, oh wow, there's like actually a place for me. And I know like representation isn't everything, but it means a lot when it's like the first thing. I always kind of thought that like being part of like movement work was just I don't know, like something outside of myself, or it was like something that was like a duty. But then when I actually saw people who looked like me who were doing this work and were organizing, it was like, oh wow, no, I'm actually like taking on the legacy of people who look like me who have done this work before, and I owe it to them who have like sacrificed so much for me to have the privileges that I have to also return the favor and like keep it going. Because if we don't, you know, we're fucked. Sorry, I don't know if I can say
Oh, no, you're good.
Oh, yeah. When we put on the radio, Rob here roasts out the 1980s beep sound straight from the Cold War. But no, I do appreciate what you said about like the kind of level of ownership that can only come from like learning about these things, you know, firsthand. And I think that's an important distinction to make for a lot of people, is that like this is not like a static history. It's like a living history that we can choose to be a part of, or we could choose to be apathetic towards. But I think more and more people are choosing to be not only, you know, interested, but like active participants, like yourself.
Yeah, I kind of to like expand upon that, because like in full disclosure, this isn't the first time we've interviewed. Like we've had you on the podcast for Step Off Radio back in 2020. But for the sake of this interview, what was it like? Because you really started learning about this history later in life. Tell us that story of that experience, because like, you grew up in Bakersfield, which is where like a lot of the UFW organizing was happening, and it kind of just blows my mind to like to be in the headquarters. Pretty much, I mean, I literally like Cesar Chavez like headquarters is like a couple miles like up the mountain, you know, so far like where this is where all this happened, and to like not learn about that and have it not in schools where you think it would be. What was that like, kind of learning about it like later in life and be like, oh, like you said, this isn't just history just happened now. This is a continuation of an ongoing legacy.
Yeah, I mean, for lack of a better word, like the first word that comes to mind is like embarrassing, because it's just like I can't believe that I wasn't even curious about this history until I had it right in front of me. And I know that that is a product of the systems that I grew up in, and the school structure and the way that it's structured to only, you know, legitimize certain kinds of history. But yeah, I think like growing up in Bakersfield and being so close to that history and like not having any idea that this was going on, it made me feel really like want to like rebel against everything that I'd ever been taught before, basically. Because I was like a really good student, like I wanted to get straight A's, I wanted to like please my parents and do all the things that like all the adults around me were like telling me to do. And so when I found out that all of this history was like hidden from me and not like told to me, I was like, well, what else have I been taught that I need to throw away or that I need to rethink and relearn? And I found out that it was basically everything, you know, like the schools really groom us to be workers, to be capitalist machines. And I don't think that's necessarily helping us become better people or learn how to survive better or even be in community with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it learning that history really just like made me rethink everything.
That'll do it. Yeah. Definitely. It's like, well, we start pulling that thread of like, this doesn't make sense. And all of a sudden the whole sweater is gone about, oh, the mythology about capitalism in the U.S. empire. Right.
Like, exactly.
And, you know, I'm so grateful for that one fact of that, all of us coming together around that fact.
Yeah. I had like a full like sweater vest suit, you know, basically
that had been
created for me that I really needed to pull.
I had a similar experience though. Cause it was like, you realize all these things and then all of a sudden you're like, well, what else is out there? And you start learning about these periods of history that obviously don't get as much focus, like why we own Hawaii as like I would call it a colony. Yeah, anyways, Rob.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Stacey, because I feel like so many people, either adjacent to us or even listening to the show, have a similar experience, whether they're taking like Chicano studies or Afro-American studies, whatever it may be, indigenous, you know, studies. Everyone kind of has like this aha moment where, like you said, like everything is bullshit, for lack of a better term, and is, we've been taught this quite literally whitewashed version of U.S. history and...
Yeah.
The misdeeds and genocide and, you know, quite frankly, you know, like war crimes committed against, you know, people in communities are just, you know, glanced over, completely just erased from the historical record. So you started off, officially started our Radical History Club in 2019. You have a background as an illustrator and a graphic designer, and these issues are beautifully illustrated and designed. People listen, if you haven't picked these up, they're incredible. I love the retro, you know, almost like old school textbook design to them. They remind me of a lot of things like I saw like when I was in elementary school. I went to a school that was like really old, open 50s, and we had like a lot of stuff still from like the 70s and stuff, like in the library, like the reference section and stuff like that. But anyways, you tell us how like publications like Kitchen Table Press and like the Black Panthers newspaper inspired the visual look and overall retro design, because I feel like that's a very integral part of like Radical History Club, is not just the information but the look and how you present this information to people.
Yeah. Oh wow, that's so nice. Thank you so much for saying that. I think Kitchen Table Press was like a really big influence, because I just love the way that their books were just super straightforward. Like there's not a lot, well, I'm sure there's a lot of thought and like work that goes into putting the covers together, but when you look at the covers, they're very simple, they're very easy to read. I can look at it and know exactly what to expect. I know exactly what I'm about to read.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't rely on like the pomp and circumstance of like glossy publishers and like, you know, these high resolution images and all that kind of stuff to sell like their publications. And so it's like the words and the work speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to bring that kind of energy and like simplicity and straightforwardness, I guess, into the zine. So that's why every issue has like the title is just like a few words or even just one word. Like, you know exactly what you're going to get into when you pick up a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as like the Black Panther newspaper, like Emery Douglas, who was the artist for that, was like one of my heroes. I feel like I look up to him so much as an artist, because he was just able to take these really like complicated issues and like distill them down into beautiful imagery that was like so simple. You just understood the message right away. And I think his work really like reflected, you know, some of like the anger and like frustration that people were feeling about their lives, and just putting it out on the page in a way that makes it feel like, oh, I can do something about it. Or like I'm moved to the point where I want to do something about it.
Right.
And it's not necessarily like, you know, like erasing people's pain or like erasing people's frustration. It's kind of like, I don't know, just like stirring the pot in a sense. Another one of my inspirations too is the Cuban Revolution, like poster makers.
Yeah, so I've achieved Super Saiyan status now with the mention of the Cuban Revolution.
Find your buzzword.
Yeah, I'm sitting here in the shadow of a portrait of Fidel. For those, I'm painting a word picture. Well, I'm sorry, continue.
That's awesome. Yeah, I feel like learning about those posters and those designers is actually one of the things that pushed me into graphic design in the first place, because it was just so cool to see how you can get so much emotion and like desire to like take action from something so simple as like a painted image or like an illustration, you know? Like it again goes back to like the accessibility thing. Like we don't need these giant paintings or like, you know, these like papers, academic papers that tell us how to feel about art. Like you can look at stuff like Emery Douglas and these poster creators and know like exactly the kind of feeling that they're going for, which I love. So yeah,
definitely. Yeah, one of the things that Jose often cites is a mística, which is, you know, like it's not just, you know, the education to get people like know about the subject matter, but it's also inspiring people, you know, motivating people. And sometimes that's not just, you know, through academics, but it's through imagery and art and symbols. Culture and, you know, exactly, symbology.
Right.
And I think that you capture a lot of these topics, which, to be frank, are very, very complicated and very nebulous sometimes. It's very hard to capture them, you know, and I think that these issues do a great job at doing that. You said you look at the cover and you know exactly what you're getting into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like the size and I like the kind of formatting because I think it really speaks to an era of our history too, where people would read these kind of things like on the floor of a factory on their job, or, you know, in a time where they wanted these things to be accessible and, you know, beautiful at the same time. And I think Rob touches on mística. I want to expand for one second because it is a Brazilian, you know, idea, right, from the MST, the landless peasant movement, and their logic, right, and I just love it, is that like culture and working class culture needs to be like obviously like uplifted in our minds and in our spaces, but that, like you mentioned, the Cubans and how they, like, you know, did their, you know, the art. I think something that I really loved too is like seeing how much like optimism like really is in those, you know, early posters and just like a lot of posters, revolutionary art, because it's like a lot of people for the first time, I think, getting actual ownership over their art. It wasn't something that was going to be sold to some rich person. It was something that was going to be like on a wall in a factory. It was going to be like in someone's neighborhood. So, yeah, I mean, building up those institutions like what you're doing with the Radical History Club, you know, with inclusion of art and culture deliberately, I think, as a deliberate thing, is an important, you know, thing that we got to keep in our minds as organizers and as working class people. Yeah,
for sure. And I also try really hard to like include, like, the photographs that I choose to put in these zines is like very intentional, because I feel like it's so easy to paint people in historical like context as needing help or being the receivers of something rather than being agents themselves. And so I really want to make sure that like every image that gets used kind of puts folks in that driver's seat rather than being people that like something happens to.
Right.
Before we go on to the next question, I wanted to follow up on one question.
Yeah.
For people that may not be aware, you know, so break down briefly, what is a zine? Because like there's a lot of people like it, sometimes zines, they have information. Sometimes they're literally just pictures. There's no words at all in them. So like, what's a good, for the people that don't know?
Yeah.
All the Zoomers, just say it. Say what it is. Shots fired out of me.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry. No, there'll be no generational bias here.
Well, I mean, like, I didn't know about zines until, you know, I started doing this project, too. So I feel like people come into this work from very different places. Like, I don't even think that I have, like, the definition of what a zine is for sure, you know? But from what I know, a zine is basically, like, just, like, a self-published medium. It's something that can be printed on paper. It can be, like, one page. It can be 10 pages. It can be 100 pages. It can be text. Some folks do zines about just random things, and some folks do zines that have more intention, like historically, like I do. But yeah, it can really be anything, and it's really more of a tool and like a medium that allows people to have access to publishing. And there's a whole, like, you know, movement behind it too. Like, we have Zine Fest here every year. It's happening again in October. And yeah, I feel like there's folks that are diehard zine fans throughout.
That's true.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because like I know like sometimes like people aren't aware of like these terms. We try, like, much like your publications, we try to, you know, make it like as accessible as possible.
Certainly. Thank you, Rob. And now back to Radical History Club. You've covered a wide variety of topics, basically everything from Reconstruction following the U.S. Civil War, all the way up to COINTELPRO and the, you know, FBI surveilling of various, you know, people's movements, one of them being the Chicano Civil Rights Movement, as well as, you know, the Black Liberation Movement, the Indigenous Liberation Movement as well. You've also covered the history of discriminatory housing policy in the U.S. And, you know, just generally U.S. imperialism. I'm holding the edition myself that we were just talking about U.S. empire and its legacy in the Philippines. So with so many undercover topics and injustices, you know, strewn throughout U.S. history, how do you go about the incredibly, you know, complicated and I'm sure difficult task of selecting which topic to go over in a given issue?
Yeah, I mean, like, I wish I had, like, a really cool way of, like, showing, like, how I choose, but honestly, it's very organic. Like, I think I started with Reconstruction, that was, like, the first issue, and it was really just a reaction to, like, oh, I really want to learn about this, and, like, while I'm learning, maybe other people want to learn about it, too, and so I'm just going to, like, put this into a zine and see if other people want access to this information, because it's so complex and complicated, and it's not taught, you know, by design. Like, there's a reason why none of us know the true story about Reconstruction. So I watched Henry Louis Gates' piece on PBS, Reconstruction, and then I watched that not too long after I saw Ava DuVernay's 13th documentary. Mm-hmm. And so I think when I saw, like, the through line from, like, Jim Crow, or from slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration, it was like, oh wow, there's, like, literally a direct line that's, like, pointing through all of history and showcasing, like, why our world looks the way that it does. Like, there are historical pieces and foundations as to why it looks this way. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've just kind of been, like, moving through life, or moving through the production of Radical History Club in that way, just kind of, like, figuring out what are some of the things that are really, like, hidden and what for what reason. And I feel like I've tried to kind of target the pieces or the moments in U.S. history that catapulted us into these really big, audacious things that we don't understand, like capitalism, empire, yeah, things like that. And so, and I also, like, ask readers too. I love talking to readers about, like, what they want to learn about. So this last volume actually is focused on imperialism because one of my readers suggested, or I think she was, like, reading a book about the Haitian Revolution. And I realized, like, oh, you know, like, a lot of the history that I thought of as, like, you quote unquote U.S. history is, like, based in the U.S., but actually the U.S. being an empire, we have influence all over the world, and actually the state of the world is in large part due to U.S. war crimes, basically. So I kind of, like, took that on as, like, an idea of, like, oh, maybe I'll just use this next volume to kind of focus on U.S. imperialism to show that it's not just, you know, the history is not just based here on this soil. It is, like, everywhere, and it cascades throughout all of the countries that we've, you know, landed in and colonized. So, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I would love to know, too, from y'all, like, what history would you like to read about?
You heard it straight from the source, everybody, you know. So, hop on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Is there a Facebook page?
Yeah. No, I don't. I'm not on Twitter. Sorry.
It's now.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. I'm old millennial now. So
honestly, some of the subjects you've already covered, U.S. imperialism, I'm really excited to see. Reconstruction makes me think of, you know, Du Bois's you know, very pivotal work on Reconstruction, mm-hmm. and some of the books that Gerald Horn has written about, like, basically the history of the U.S. And yeah, I mean, honestly, seeing more of those subjects, I mean, I think can only do our community more of a justice, you know, like, by having more of that out there.
Every one of these subjects that I talked about here, you know, you could have, like, entire college courses dedicated to study, yes. these, you know, like,
yes.
from Reconstruction to the Chicano movement to the American Indian movement, all of these, like, you can have, like, multiple courses on all these topics. So you have a daunting task when you make these of compiling a massive amount of history and you compile them into what is on average an 18 to 20 page booklet. How long does research for a topic on a given issue of Radical History Club take? And also with that said, what subject has taken the longest and required the most comprehensive research?
Yeah, so in the beginning, I think I was, like, I didn't really know what I was doing and just kind of, like, researching as much as I could for about a month and then, like, then going into, like, the production phase of it. But I think as my process has kind of developed, the research process has actually become the bulk of the thing. So what used to take me a month takes me about, like, 7 months to sometimes even, like, a couple years. Mm-hmm. Because I just feel like there's so much history that's written from different perspectives, from biased perspectives, especially ones that, like, elevate the U.S. as like a savior, or don't really think about, you know, like history in terms of women, in terms of queer folks, in terms of disabled folks, like all those folks get left out of the narrative. And so I realized that, like, in doing this research, I really don't want these just to be like book reports of like what's already out there, and just trying to like find who are those folks that are like left out of the story, and like how can I them back in sort of through this zine process. And like, so then the research takes much longer. For instance, for like this Philippines issue, it actually took me 2 years to do the research, because I started thinking like, oh, if I just like focus on like maybe like Filipino writers, like maybe I'll get the accurate history. And then it was like, oh wait, no, that doesn't work, because there's so much of the history that's been like misled and misrepresented to, again, think of the U.S. as a savior, and to think of U.S. imperialism as a good thing, and to think that like the Philippines, the people of the Philippines, like can't take care of themselves or can't have their own resources or own their own land, basically. So yeah, it took me a while to kind of like pivot and realize like, oh, I'm like learning the wrong stuff, or I'm like learning from the wrong perspectives. So it took me a while to kind of like reformat who I was reading and like what kinds of history I was like looking into. And then there's also like the personal aspect too, of like just like learning this history and just being like, oh shit, like there is so much like messed up stuff that has happened to people, to like working class people around the world, and especially people who live in other countries that are not the US. And it's heartbreaking. And especially when it's your own people who you already feel, and I'm speaking personally, like who you already feel distance from just by the nature of living here in the US. Like I already feel a disconnect with that. And then on top of that, learning this history and not having known it before. So like there's a lot of like self forgiveness and like learning that like comes with that. And I think it's like, it's good that I'm able to like take time to like heal, to like learn this history, and then like pause and just like gather myself and understand that, like, you know, I'm trying really hard not to like take it too hard on myself, to that I didn't have access to this knowledge, or that I didn't know about it before, so that I can like move forward.
Right. There's like superstructural elements, like you mentioned, to badly quote Gramsci, I'm assuming, like that, like, you know, are the reason why we don't know these things, especially as people that are living in the part of these diasporic communities. Right. Like, and you pointed out, like, there's a very deliberate reason why we're not taught this history coming from these communities. It's about extraction of resources and labor and all these other things that, like you mentioned imperialism before.
Yeah.
That's its whole purpose after, you know, Manifest Destiny was to like open up markets for U.S. goods and also to like strip them of their resources. So it's definitely an interesting thing. I want to like, I can talk about imperialism all day, as Rob knows. So
could we all?
Yes, go as we should.
Yes.
As we all should. But ultimately the mission of Radical History Club is ultimately to unsettle and challenge colonizer, capitalist, and anti-Black narratives, you know, that are very, as you pointed out, prevalent and present and entrenched in higher institutions of power like universities. Why do you believe it is so important to people, for people to be exposed to this kind of history, specifically radical, more, I guess, like social political narratives focusing on workers of all stripes? Rather than like the political history of kings and queens and whatever. Why do you think that, you know, history needs to be refocused out of this broader like U.S. dominant narrative and more towards, you know, being focused through the lens of marginalized or oppressed communities?
Yeah, I think it's so important because like we have this, you know, tendency to put people on pedestals, like the presidents, like even like to the point of like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Like he has done so much. And also, who are the women who cooked his meals? Who are the people who organized his rallies? Like there's so much to be said about the everyday ordinary people that live, you know, pretty mundane lives that still go out there and organize and still go out there and like bring their communities together to make change. So I think it's really important to focus on this history and not on, you know, individuals, because it is going to require all of us to take on some of that responsibility. And like, I don't want to say that like, oh yeah, I'm doing it, like raising the flag saying that I'm doing everything so perfectly. Like, I know that I have stuff to work on and that I can always do better. But I also want us to like focus on what are those everyday things that we could do. And it's kind of like what I was saying before about like being radical is caring for each other and like caring about how we treat each other. And I feel like that is revolutionary in and of itself. It's not necessarily the people that are like in the lead, like leading marches and protests. It's like the people that are just caring about each other and checking in on each other and doing this work in a way that sustains us in the long term.
Yeah, we can quote, I think, Che with that famous and oftentimes, you know, badly paraphrased by myself quote that, like, well, I think at the heart of a revolutionary is love, right? Is that like a feeling of love for the people? And yeah, definitely, I think a powerful motivator for sure.
Yeah,
thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Stacey. So last time that we spoke was back in 2020. And at that time, there was a lot of talk and, you know, controversy about so-called critical race theory, particularly in high schools and universities. Fast forward to 2023, that rhetoric has not calmed down. If anything, it has reached a fever pitch at this point. And I wanted to ask you, what do you believe is the significance of creating curriculum like this for students and young people that not only challenges this mythology that's passed off as history, but replaces them with more accurate accounts, I communities, like you were saying, you know, people that are traditionally ignored by the history books and have been written out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, there's a reason, obviously. Like, we've all been talking about all of this stuff happening by design. Like, there's a reason why the uprisings in 2020 led to this, like, co-optation of, like, anti-wokeness, like, or of co-optation of the idea of wokeness, that somehow it means that you're being unreasonable or that you don't know the truth. Like, I think that the right and, like, fascist state is so well organized that they can steer us so easily by dangling this, like, anti-wokeness narrative in front of our faces. But it's intentional, right? Like, it's so that we calm down or, like, quiet ourselves, so that we edit ourselves, so that we don't show up completely authentically and try to strive to, like, learn more about ourselves and to, like, change our opinions about stuff. Like, there's a reason why these attacks are so coordinated and why they've escalated to this point. So I think, like, this curriculum and curriculum, like, Radical History Club is so important because, like, we need to show people that it's almost like a matter of life or death in order to learn this history. It's not, you know, just something that we can pat ourselves on the back for, like, oh, look what I learned. Like, look at this certificate that I got for, like, taking this class.
Merit badge. You know?
Although I will say, each kid shoot does come with a badge.
No. I said, like, badges are cool. I want to put them on stuff. But I'm talking about, like, you know, like, if you're just going to wear a badge without a button. Like I said, I would rock with a button. You know what I'm saying? But I mean, if I was going to walk around with a button and it didn't work, you know what I'm saying? What good is the button if it's not attached to me doing something active?
Yes, exactly.
Sorry, my bad. I didn't mean to derail. I was just saying, like, yeah, like.
I totally get it. Yeah, no, it's more than, like, having the proof that you learned this stuff. It's also, like, well, what are you going to do with that information? Like, that's the step that, you know, all the folks on the right are organizing against. Like, they think that if they just cut it off at the root, where we just, like, stop learning about this stuff and we're afraid to learn about it, that we then won't take action to change the conditions that we're in. Because we're just, if we don't have access to this history, we're just going to keep on thinking that, like, all of this stuff is our fault. That, like, I can't afford groceries because I'm not working hard enough, or my rent is so high because I need to put more hours in at the job, or I need to please my boss, or stop, you know, taking care of myself and my family so that I can work more and have another job. Like, I feel like this co-optation of wokeness is, like, kind of, like, functioning to, like, silence us and also to prevent us from, like, learning how to change things.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, we can see these models throughout history, right? Of whenever there's a surge of working class, because frankly, the working class is the only revolutionary class, I would say, the driving force. There's a reason why that, you know, after the uprisings, it was working class people, the servers, the service workers that were out there, you know, here in La Mesa, burning down the banks and, like, raiding, not, like, you know, the banks for funds, but, like, the grocery stores of all things. And I think that, people, you know, can really, I think, lose sight of that, like, the working class is the one that kind of sets the pace. And that co-optation, like you mentioned, is the kind of reaction to that. Like, and it's not something that, like, we are surprised by. It's just, I think we're, you know, I think the words Malcolm X, right? That we're not out organized. We're not outnumbered. We're out organized, right? Really? That, like, the forces of the ruling class look around. They're like, oh, my God, like, they're coming for our necks.
Yes.
And then they mobilize, you know, their fascist, you know, thugs, you know, on these ideas of like challenging wokeness or like, you know, these forces of reaction, right? Oh, LGBTQ people, women are your enemy. Mm-hmm. And in reality, it's like the guy who like sent, you know, who took away your hours and is cutting your pension and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it's definitely a very poignant fact to mention that, like, you know, these are, this reaction, this surge is like, they're directly tied because of the like power of working class people, and they have to kind of like come with that like oppression to try and squash it. And so far, unfortunately, the times where we've been less than organized, they've been more successful at rolling back some of those gains that we've gotten. I look at, you know, some of the Supreme Court rulings that we've had recently as proof of that, right? Of like that once militant mass movement, the second they feel it kind of wane even an inch, they're like, boom, right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think like the tendency, especially when it comes to like young people, like I'm not a youth, I guess, in a traditional sense, so I don't want to speak for them, but I will speak for myself when I was a younger person.
Sure.
That I took on a lot of this like narrative of like, okay, I have to like work really hard. I have to get straight A's. I have to please all these people in order to have value, in order to be seen as like a human being. And so I'm going to do all of that, I guess, and just ignore all the folks who seem like they're doing something else or like going against the status quo, because this is what my parents taught me, what it means to survive, like just to follow instructions and like go down this pathway. So I think like this curriculum, again, is like so important so that we get out of that like journey, and so that kids can have access to this knowledge like sooner, so that we don't have to spend, you know, like a quarter of our lives trying to like unlearn all of this horrible stuff.
That's right. Get them young and make sure that they don't have to go through the pain we went through. Yeah,
I know.
Exactly. Like to badly paraphrase Cesar Chavez, you know, he said something along the lines of, you know, you can't keep down people who know their history. You know, you can't intimidate people who take pride in where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you know, people who know where they come from know where they're going.
Yeah.
Well. So I think that teaching young people from a very young age to take pride in this and know that they're not just starting from point zero, there's a legacy that they stand upon, and they could look back at this and look how past generations have, you know, fought against similar and sometimes even greater obstacles. You know, we can apply this to contemporary times too now, I think is very powerful.
Yeah, for sure.
I wanted to ask you, you know, like, so Radical History Club, these have been used, you know, everywhere from high school history classes all the way up to collegiate universities. And I wanted to ask, you know, what has been the reaction from educators who have used your text in their classrooms?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really good. Like, those are the first people that told me that this was, like, a project worth pursuing. You know, like, when I saw teachers who are, like, librarians and people in the education space, like, being so excited about them. Like, I remember the very first thing I ever did with the zine was at San Diego Zine Fest, like, back in 2019. And most of the people that came to my table were librarians and teachers. And they were just so excited to see something that their kids could also get excited about, so that they didn't have to read a boring textbook that was super ugly and didn't like speak to them in the way that they wanted to be spoken to. So I feel like I'm sorry, I already forgot what your question was.
No, I was just saying, like, what has been like the reaction?
The reaction, right? Yeah. Sorry about that.
It's all good.
So I feel like people have been really excited about it. It's been really great. Like some people, like you mentioned, have taken it into their classrooms. One of my favorite things that I've seen people do is actually have their students do zines themselves.
Nice.
So they'll teach them about the history or, you know, whatever the lesson is, and then have the students then take ownership of that narrative and like present it to other folks instead. I feel like that's so powerful to see them use like this medium of like expression and like creativity to be able to like show what they've learned and to like reinterpret it and reimagine it in a way that like speaks to them. Yeah, some of the zines that I've seen like online that that students have made are just like so cool. They're so good. Awesome. And like, yeah, I'm like, oh, I wish I could have a copy of this, but I know it's there. So
the kids are all right, right?
Yeah.
Like they're out here making zines. They're like, they're getting into it.
Physical media ain't dead. Don't believe the hype. You know?
Yeah, that's right. There we go. As we say, getting ready for the radio. But that being said, you know, like mentioned, you've been. Right, some of the research takes sometimes months, sometimes years. What have you learned while conducting research for the series, just in general, like as like a general rule of thumb? Have you learned anything to make it easier? But also, what surprised you most when you were conducting this background research? Like, was there anything that you just had to stop and be like, oh my gosh, like I did not know that at all?
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the things that...
I don't know why another...
Fun little triangle.
Yeah, and the funny thing, for those who can't see it, I had written on the back of my paper to Rob, like, is your phone off?
Oh, I came prepared.
Yeah.
Every time it's someone, we switch off. I'll edit this out.
Yeah. That's just funny because, like, it's there's no reason. That was for a nap I took in Atlanta, Georgia. And so, like, last week. So there's no reason for that to be on there anymore. My apologies.
1 week later.
Let's run that question back again because I feel like I've done a lot of research for this series. Sometimes it takes, like, a couple of months. You mentioned sometimes it takes a couple of years even. What surprised you the most while you were conducting the background research for the Radical History Club?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess what surprises me the most is, like, just learning about all of these individual, like, stories and, like, especially looking at primary resources and understanding history from the perspective of people who were actually there on the spot. I mean, only because I just did this research very recently, I just remember reading letters from U.S. soldiers during the Philippine colonization. Yeah.
Rough stuff, yeah.
Exactly. And just, like, while also knowing that our people are recruited for the military, like, more often than any other group, you know?
Sipig Day?
Exactly. So it's just, like, to know this history and to know how Filipino people were treated and thought of, it's just kind of, like, the brainwashing that's required to, like, make these people feel inhuman so that you can then go to their homeland and kill and murder and take over their resources. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's such a sad thing that has to happen in order for us to feel, like, okay with these institutions for some reason. So that took me a while to kind of, like, sit with and just, like, process. But I think, like, I mean, I hate to, like, look at a silver lining, but a silver lining is that it did help me see, like, the through line, like, that history can be a way to build solidarity with other people. Because, you know, like, if you don't know about some of these letters, you know, some of the soldiers were referring to the Filipino people by using the N-word, by using racial slurs that were traditionally used for Black people at home.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, there were Black soldiers who were actually in the military who were using their, I mean, not all, but some folks believed that being in the military, or some Black folks believed that being in the military would grant them powers or access to things that they didn't have back home. Like, it would, like, legitimize them as being, like, a true, you know, U.S. patriot or whatever the hell you want to call it. And so I think, like, just learning about this history and learning, like, these little moments of where, wow, we're actually all sometimes racialized to be seen as the enemy. And anti-Blackness is the core. Like, it's not something that is only hurled at Black folks. And not to say that, like, we all, you know, have the same kinds of oppression. We obviously have different kinds. But it is designed in a way to target, to put a target on our backs in order to serve the empire, in order to do whatever it is that the U.S. wants to accomplish. So I think, like, that's one of the most surprising things, is seeing that, like, on paper, like, through primary sources, that, like, tradition.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I read those letters, some of them as well, when I was in college, because I was also interested on the Filipino-American Wars and, like, you know, really what the legacy of that, and the way that not only did they mention the, like, racial slurs, but, like, the idea of replacing the Filipino people and raising up the Philippines as, like, a colony of the United States in an era where that was, like, a very, you know, popular idea with the Berlin Conference in Africa, you know, and all these other things that had happened where they just basically divvied up our homelands as, like, you know, places for us, them to get different things and to either, you know, kill or replace our people. Yeah, definitely some harsh stuff reading those letters. But you, like you mentioned, silver lining, kind of formative stuff too, to be like, oh, this is bigger than just, like, here, because the same story is told, and where my family's from, in Colombia, in Honduras, and you, like, mentioned the Philippines, and Vietnam, and all these other places, wherever U.S., you know, boots have touched ground, basically, the same kind of narrative has played out in various ways and forms. So yeah, thank you for sharing that background. That definitely, yeah, that'll be something that would make me sit and think, I think, a little bit too after reading about that for the first time. It did, actually, I can say.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, just to, like, also expand upon that too, like my family is from the Philippines. They were privileged enough to be able to come here, but it's also like sometimes when you're like younger and you ask like, why are we here? Like, well, how did we get here?
Right.
Often the answer is like, oh, we wanted to build a better life. Right. Or like, we wanted you kids to have like access to more stuff. Right. And then the kind of like the conversation like stops there. Like we don't actually ask like, why? Like, why did we have to leave our homeland in order to have a better life? And that conversation or that thought is often like not finished unless you have access to this history.
That's right. Yeah. Very good point. And I think something that a lot of us can share that experience of why are we here? Oh, for freedom and all these other for a better life. But it, you know, it's not like our homes were poor or you know, not beautiful or able to sustain life.
I think literally all three of us sitting here, we don't have to go very far in our family lineages to see why our families left, and they weren't for great reasons. Like, it's because they had to, and like their lives were in danger, or is in search of, you know, like work or lack of resources, you know, because of U.S. imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's really crazy how, like, you know, for not just the three of us, but quite a significant portion of the population, you know, we don't have to go very far to see, you know, like why, like our families have had to immigrate here, yeah, you know?
Yeah. And it's often like a, like, again, like going back to the self-blaming thing, like it often is put on themselves as like, oh, well, there's something wrong with our people and that's why we had to like leave. Like, I mean, I don't want to put my parents on blast. They probably won't listen to this, but like they have said, you know, that they blame like the Philippine government for being corrupt and for like not taking care of its people. And that's like why one of the reasons why they had to leave. But again, it's like, well, why do you think that they are so corrupt? Like, they learned all that from the U.S. Like,
put them in power. Exactly. Yeah. Literally, they put the Marcos family in power directly. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, you know, having those conversations with our families who sometimes either omit or sometimes maybe just don't even know themselves that history all the way is like, you know, always an interesting experience, but I think so important. So that's cool that you've had that conversation, or at least, you know, mentioned it.
You know, kind of following up on this question, like, it's that being said, you know, a lot of like this topic, the topics that you cover in Radical History Clubs since 2019 are like, they're very heavy. Needless to say, they're very difficult conversations to have. So, what's been like the most enjoyable topic I think to cover on this?
Just moments of beauty.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I don't think I would do this if it didn't somehow like give me something back, you know. I mean, like, I know that you asked specifically about a topic, but I also want to say that like meeting the people that I've met by having this zine like exist has been just like so powerful and like affirming. Like, I think when I'm like a freelance graphic designer, and so I'm often like working alone, and so when you're working alone and by yourself, you often think like it's just me, nobody else really cares, but doing a project like this has been really like beneficial to like my mental health and like building a community and like finding other folks like you guys who like, you know, are doing part of this work and also want to be part of like Radical History Club. Like, that's really awesome. But as far as like topics that I've enjoyed, I mean, like, I hate to like keep going back to this issue, but it honestly is the last one, which is about the Philippines, because it is so personal. Like, it is something that I needed to learn desperately. And I also know that I couldn't learn it at any other time before this. Like, if I had tried to like start with this, like, I would have probably given up on Radical History Club, because I really needed like a backbone of like understanding history from the lens of repressed working class folks before jumping into what that means for the Philippines and what that means for like Filipino Americans who are here. So I would like to say that that's one of the issues that I enjoyed researching and learning about the most, because I feel like I took on a lot of like knowledge about myself and like where I come from, and it also again like helped contextualize my family story and like why we're here and the stories that they've told me about their experiences. Not to say that their experiences aren't their own, because, you know, I do understand why they think the way that they do, and it's a matter of survival, it's a matter of like taking care of your mental health. I get that. But I think like doing the research has kind of like built this whole other world around it, to where now I can understand it at a more deeper level, and also like know, you know, why the Philippines looks the way it does today.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah.
Because it's like you said, like being a freelancer and like the creator of this too, you don't always get feedback,
mm-hmm.
you know, or questions about stuff like this. And like as a freelance journalist too, it's all like it's very
I don't say the word validate, but when you hear back from other people, like, oh, wow, this is a point, you're like, yes, there are other people here that still care about this too. I'm not just screaming into the void.
Yeah, absolutely. There's like something out there in the world that is like everything that I love and like that represents everything about me. Like it's like research, illustration, design, like community building, like it's all in one package. And so I feel like it helps me find other folks who also enjoy that kind of stuff.
Yeah, having that connection to your labor, right? Like you mentioned, like labor under capitalism is so isolating. We all feel like so bad all the time working this money for other people. But when we get to do things that are important, that we care about, it feels good. People like to do things that feel good. And they also like to put in labor towards things that they like.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess I just want to ask, ultimately, what do you hope readers of the Radical History Club series take away from these issues you've produced?
I mean, I really hope that people feel called to take action. I think it's like very easy to like read this history, read books, watch documentaries and be like, okay, that was cool. Like go back to my day job, you know? I know that we all have to work to survive. Like I know we all have like a 9-to-5 that we have to go to and that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, I think it's like in every interaction that you have with another human being, you can always bring this work in.
Definitely. Like yes.
Calling into question what someone might say offhand that like doesn't make you feel good or would be like really offensive if someone else was there. Or even like to the whole other side of like joining an organization. Like I hope that if you don't take anything away from Radical History Club other than this, it's that we have to organize. Like there is no way that we are going to be able to survive the rest of this world unless we get organized and unless we like build communities and relationships with each other. And that is a very romanticized thing that we all like to say, and it's a lot of hard work, and I have not nailed it. Again, like I said, I'm a baby organizer. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm trying. And so I hope that, yeah, people just want to take action and organize.
Thank you so much for saying this, because I think that, you know, a lot of it, I think I've talked to, you know, academics or whoever these people are that, you know, it's like ideological or like exercise, right? There's just like this academic exercise of you put these things out, but like with a kind of direction like that of like, oh, no, take this into the real world and do something with it. It makes me think of like the, you know, like if somebody were to be like, well, I have X, Y, or Z. It's like, well, so did the like Cuban peasant and the Vietnamese like worker and all these people who were like, you know, equally also had things that probably were pulling away from them, but yet they did it. Right. And so, I mean, I think that's a very powerful and optimistic narrative to kind of end with. Let's say you, Rob.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that people forget so often is like you said, is that it's organizing, is to get organized, and especially because like it's very nature, the U.S., we live in a very individualistic society.
Oh,
and
God.
I think that when you compound things like social media and stuff like that, everyone has their own brand.
What about or their club, own, Rob? Their own.
Exactly. You know, like, you know, don't forget to like and subscribe, you know. Yeah, you know, like everybody does they have their own philosophy, their own ism, but you know, but when we follow, when we actually pull our resources, whether that's, you know, our time, our energy, our knowledge, you know, our art, you know, designing something like this, you know, we all have a part to play.
Yep.
And, you know, in every revolution, every successful revolution has been through successfully accomplished organizing. So I also appreciate that you drove that point home to the listeners.
Definitely.
So with that said, I wanted to ask, can you let our listeners know, where can people find Radical History Club? How can they follow you guys online and see your other work and get all the latest updates for any future issues?
Yeah, so I'm just, there's a website, radicalhistoryclub.com, very easy to remember, and then also Radical History Club on Instagram. I'm also going to be at Zine Fest in San Diego in October, and any other place that will have me. That will let me have a table.
Well, with that being said, I will definitely be in contact with you, because we are possibly tabling at all of our upcoming events. Actually, Rob is going to be tabling pretty soon. We'll talk about that after.
Yeah. And to follow up with that question, so like I know last time we spoke, which was in 2021, I believe, you had just begun work on this latest issue. So like as you said, you know, like the time in between issues can vary depending on like the topic and like how much research you have to put in. Do you have any idea on what the next topic you may want to work on? You know, not to give it away or anything, but are there any in particular in your mind that stick out that you might want to cover?
I have a suggestion, maybe.
Do tell.
I mean, maybe like a history of like anti-communism or a history of socialism in the United States, given its kind of constant being brought up. But like, what is the, how familiar are working class people with the actual definition of it? Like, what does it mean? Because if Nancy Pelosi's a socialist, then I think we're all in trouble. But I would argue that there's a different definition for socialist. Rob's heard me talk about it a million times.
That's a good one, though. That's definitely an issue that we need to hear.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Just my two cents.
No, thank you for that. I mean, since this issue or this set of volume is focused on imperialism, I'm going to keep working down this path. And so actually the reader who was talking about the Haitian Revolution is the one who actually inspired this volume to be about imperialism. Oh. So I have to do her justice and have the next issue be about the Haitian Revolution.
Also dope. There we go.
And, you know, I haven't even started research on it yet, so I can't say that I'm, like, an expert on it at all. But I feel like this volume, you know, starting with indigenous resistance here on U.S. soil, then going to the Philippines and focusing on the introduction of U.S. empire, then going to the Haitian Revolution to focus on, you know, what a successful revolution might look like and how they're continued to be punished today.
Sure.
Is something that I think readers could really enjoy. So I hope you enjoy it when it comes out.
Definitely. Absolutely. And very relevant to us here in San Diego, given how many Haitian people are literally like in solidarity and having to wait right across that border with our own people from Central and South America and all over the world. Mm-hmm. Any closing comments or anything else you want to let our listeners know about yourself and Radical History Club?
Like I said, a lot, but if you want to do work like this, you should. It can't just be a select few. It shouldn't be just a select few. If you have something to say, make a zine, do a podcast, be on a radio show, like do whatever you can to have that story be put out. And even if it's your own personal story, like I think like the Filipino Migrant Center recently did like a workshop for like young students to interview their parents about their migration story. And something that they said through that was like, no one's going to tell your history except for you. Like, you're the only one who has access to your family history. So be curious about where you come from, about where your family comes from. And it's probably going to be really difficult and very uncomfortable if you have a family like mine. But it's very powerful to know where you come from and what your family's been through.
That's right. Great advice. Great suggestion. Everybody, go out and talk to your parents right now and get that history. Get that information.
Well, do it, man. Do it, because they say talk to your family and your relatives while they're still relatives and not when they're ancestors. You know,
hey.
While they're still here.
Yeah.
And again, Rob, that's true. Yeah, you know, well, I definitely appreciate you, Stacey, coming onto the show, bringing up multiple things that I was very happy to talk about. The Cuban Revolution, this also, we're talking about U.S. imperialism, we're talking about the Philippines. It's like, you know, definitely a lot that I loved talking about today.
Yes.
Well, you know, I guess in the context of like dismantling and trying to smash the U.S. empire. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Stacey, for taking the time out of your day to come speak with us. We greatly appreciate you coming back on, and we hope to have you back again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Yeah. Internet, San Diego, wherever you're listening to, Stacey Yui of Radical History Club. You can go out and get all the issues right now. Make sure to catch her at San Diego Zine Fest in October. And with that said, we out.
Bye-bye.
Peace.
This episode of Step Off Radio is recorded at the Justice Center, San Diego. And our music was done by DJ Root. This has been a Step Off Magazine production.